Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Chelsea Bond with Let's Talk.
I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners and the land in which we're recording from today. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners and the land in which you're listening from today. I'd also like to acknowledge our elders, both past and present, Indigenous and non-Indigenous. I'd like to thank you for tuning in to Let's Talk today. I'm sounding a bit different this morning because I've almost lost my voice, so bear with me. But I've got a really interesting guest this morning, and it's funny, people often ask me what guests I invite in and why I invite certain guests in. And I basically invite people that I kind of know, but also that are doing really interesting things or that I can have an interesting yarn with. So my guest this morning is a colleague from the University of Queensland. Well, kind of colleague. We work at the same institution. And it's Associate Professor Murray Phillips, who is a sports historian at the University of Queensland School of Human Movements. Thanks for joining us on the show today, Murray.
Thanks for having me, Chelsea.
Now, look, we're going to talk about sport. We're going to talk a bit about football because it's origin time.
Yeah, football time.
I might talk a bit about racism because you know I've got to go there.
Absolutely.
I can't help myself. But as is tradition in this show, I'd like to start with if you could tell us about who your mob are, where you come from.
So I'm a Brisbane boy.
Mm-hmm.
Lived here most of my life, but as part of my academic journey, I lived in Adelaide and lived in Canberra for over a decade. So Brisbane boy, but travelled around a bit, and through my work I get to travel a lot. And over the last 10 or so years, been really interested in Indigenous sport.
Mm. And how did you become, like, have you always been a sports historian? Like, how did you get that gig?
No, actually, I was a PE teacher.
Oh, really?
I was indeed.
What, primary school, high school?
Primary school.
Oh, there you go.
Up in Ipswich.
True.
Yeah,
there you go.
A couple of years up there, and I was also an avid rugby union player, and I wanted to play for Queensland, and I got transferred to Mareeba.
Wow.
And my coach at the time said, that's not going to help your rugby career. So I just went back to university by default. And then I was a little bit more mature, a little bit longer out of school, so I dived into an arts degree and got into history and culture and Indigenous studies. And then I just seemed to stumble my way through a postgraduate degree onto a PhD and then landed a job in sports history.
Wow. See, you're pretty tall. I mean, everyone's tall compared to me, but I would have thought you was a basketball player.
Well, my sons are basketball players. They were smart enough not to play rugby union, so.
Yeah, I would never pick union. What did you do your postgrad studies in?
Okay, so it was in history with a focus area on sport history. And that's how I became a sport historian, essentially. So my PhD was in sport in World War One.
Wow. Mm. So you had this, you wanted to be a professional athlete and then decided, well, I'm just going to stick around sports and sports history kind of thing.
Well, in my days, it was amateur. So rugby union was an amateur game as opposed to rugby league, which we'll talk about today, which is a professional game. Union is a middle-class game, primarily out of the private schools. And you weren't paid up until the mid-90s, and I finished in the early 90s, I think, playing rugby union. So.
And so how long have you been working as an academic at the University of Queensland?
I've been at UQ since 2000, and I was at Canberra University for 7 years and 3 years at the University of South Australia.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you're a sports historian, so you do research, but you also teach. So can you tell us about what you teach?
Well, the focal point of my teaching is really to get students to understand that sport's a really interesting activity, but it sits in a really broader cultural context.
Mm.
And you can only really understand sport if you understand the cultural context. Otherwise, it's just a competition that you're watching.
Mm. And do students get that? Is there resistance to that? Like, is there a sense of understanding why that's important? Or
no, because the way we teach is we introduce kind of contemporary topics all the time, which gets their consciousness up about, well, yeah, there are other things going on here than just the score. There's some dynamic that's playing out, whether it's gender or race or ethnicity or age or geographic identity or nationalism, patriotism.
There's certain, you know, mythologies that circulate around sport that I think many of us come to believe, like the whole, you know, sport is a level playing field and that kind of thing. Is that part of what you kind of examine or challenge?
Absolutely. Look, if you talk to anyone, they can talk about sport.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to a barbecue, all the guys line up and they start talking sport. If they've got nothing else in common, they'll talk about sport.
Mm.
And everyone has an opinion about sport.
Right.
And this, I say to the students, you've all got an opinion, so I want to hear it. So we'll talk about it. And then the whole semester is actually trying to deconstruct those ideas they've got in their head about how sport is at a level playing field. And it's good for Indigenous people because they get all these opportunities.
But we're naturally gifted, of course.
Oh, talented athletes. So it's all obvious. So the semester is really about deconstructing those ideas.
Mm.
There's a body of scholarship now, you know, a 50-year body of scholarship that's looked at sport critically.
Yeah.
That says that you need to understand society and you put those two together, sport and society, and then you can kind of understand how it functions in a really quite a complex way. Sport is a really simple institution at one level. Someone wins, someone loses. It's that simple. But as soon as you peel back the layers of the onion, you get to understand, wow, there's lots of stuff going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Even who gets to play and who doesn't get to play.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At a really fundamental level. That's a kind of critical cultural issue.
And so, I mean, I guess you're getting students to think about things like race, class, gender. And certainly my experience in teaching in Indigenous studies, we encourage students to critically examine how they've come to know the world. And sometimes you can get a bit of resistance, hostility for students to have to, you know, question the way they've come to know the world and the truths they've come to accept. Do you have that when you're trying to get students to kind of...
Certainly do, because in this course really challenge the kind of status quo.
Mm.
So this is the way sport is, but do you realise how it's got there and how it actually works in the favour of some people and against other people? And you may be, if you're white and male, you've been one of the privileged groups.
Mm.
You're lucky. You may not have ever felt this. But if you're black or if you're female or if you've come from, developing country or if you're a refugee, you know this institution is not equitable and fair for everybody.
Mm.
And getting them beyond their comfort zone is the challenge in these courses.
Mm. And you have any tips for how you navigate student resistance to that? Like, how do you walk students along?
Well, one of the tactics that I use is we have a whole lot of contemporary issues that come up in sport every day.
Mm.
So I usually just go to a contemporary issue and say, okay, look, Adam Goods has been, racially abused here. What's going on here? And that'll be the discussion point of which they enter in an argument in which they don't know there's 20 or 30 years of scholarship about Indigenous identity in sport.
Mm.
So then we say, well, okay, that's an interesting point, but a lot of the research has actually pointed to this issue, and sports have adjusted these ways. And if you put that in the broader context of Adam Goods's life or his background or the fate of Indigenous people, then you start to see this so differently.
Mm.
So it's a soft pedal approach to get them to think critically about, contemporary issues. And then we go back into, all right, let's have a look at the way in which Indigenous people have related to sport over the last century. Let's do that. Let's see if it has been fair and equitable and if they've given a shot in every sport or whether it's actually worked against them in many instances.
Mm.
Or the way in which Indigenous people have grabbed some sports, but for some reason or another, they're not in any sports. So why is it that we don't have Indigenous people right across the board in all the sports?
Mm.
What are the structural issues that are actually keeping Indigenous people away from some sports? Or what are the really subtle things that are playing out in society which don't allow Indigenous people to have an open door policy for Indigenous people? Why aren't they walking through that door? It might be open, but there'll be other really subtle things going on that as a white person you may not pick up on.
Mm, true. And so that encouraging students to engage intellectual level as opposed to just that emotive response to what they think and feel.
That's
right. Let's actually look at the facts and,
so
the scholarly work.
We engage at the emotional level to start with because they can engage. They saw this event or they heard about it or saw it on the news or whatever. And then we can peel it back and say, okay, look, a lot of people have worked on this kind of issue. Let's see what they've said and what kind of research have they done to actually back up their ideas and what's been discredited and what's been validated. And so it's a process that we get them to start to understand, well, when you form knowledge about something, how do you do that? How do you construct knowledge around what's already existing in the knowledge bank that you can pull on?
Mm-hmm. I remember we developed a kind of a mini lecture for some Indigenous students who were coming on campus, and I think with yourself and with your colleague, Dr. Gary Osman, and it was interesting doing it with Indigenous students, and we started off with getting them to name the famous Indigenous athletes that they knew of, and got them to look at the list and think about why that is, you know, what they notice and why that is so. And of course, what we had is a really long list of Indigenous male footballers, rugby league players. We had a couple of female athletes, you know, the Yvonne Goolagong, Kathy Freeman. But for the most part, it was rugby league, rugby union. And it was men. And it was interesting. What was interesting for me was the students were really, you know, these were early high school students who were able to detect the trends around race, class and gender, that there were some interesting patterns and they could recognise those patterns and could come up with some explanations why. Some of the explanations were some of the kind of sort of stereotypical ideas. You know, but I've had some young boys talk about, you know, well, because boys are better at sport. That's why that all the so we had some healthy debate in the classroom, yeah. But it was interesting seeing students starting to question these things and their willingness. So I was thought maybe we yarn about this stuff about, you know, what is it about rugby league, particular that you think that why is it such a strong thing in our community?
I think rugby league is one of those games that has had a semi-open door for Indigenous people.
Okay,
so you think about this.
What do you mean by semi-open door?
Well, semi-open door in the sense that it's always rugby league has always been interested in generating income through paying spectators. Right, so they needed to do that immediately when they started. So rugby league kicked off in 1907, and rugby union is actually the older game. So
okay.
It was the younger brother who had to actually grow and develop, and they did that by commercialising the game, whereas the amateur rugby union didn't want to commercialise the game. So the rugby league commercialised the game, and as part of that, they said, well, we need the best athletes, the best footballers playing this game. So the door was partially open. So Indigenous people were given the opportunity to participate in small numbers and due to specific circumstances, but they were never actually held out of rugby league teams. Deliberately, as opposed to rugby union, which was a middle-class activity that privileged white people and their participation because the game was played mainly in the private schools in which Indigenous people didn't have access
to. So in terms of union's origins, it's the public-private school kind of opportunity. That has a long history. It's not a new thing.
Clear class divide between rugby union and rugby league. So rugby union has always been middle-class and rugby league... was formed from working class participants in the working class suburbs of Sydney and Brisbane.
Yeah.
And it developed along different kinds of lines. So they actually changed the rules. It was rugby union when they started, and they changed the rules, so they got rid of some of the basic rules we know that exist in rugby union to create rugby league. And it's always had an eye on the spectator. So if there was a flashy, talented player, no matter whether they were white or black, they could get a gig.
Right.
But that's in the broader context of the way in which Indigenous people lived their lives in Australia, which, you know, the institutional racism worked against Indigenous people getting a full run at rugby league, as at any sport.
So in terms of sort of our early, I guess, Indigenous rugby league stars that hit the mainstream, who were some of those characters that in the history books who were sort of...
Well, there were some players who played in the... early part of the 1900s in the Sydney teams in particular. So there was a couple of standout players in those early teams, and that was the burgeoning of rugby league, the early times. But really, rugby league really didn't kick off in, well, Indigenous players in the white competitions until the 1960s. There were some through the 1950s, 1970s it really took off. So rugby league players from Indigenous communities were where the game grew. So that you've got the odd one playing in the Sydney competition, in the Brisbane competition, but not many. But it was in the communities that it actually really grew. So in settlements like Cherbourg and Warrabinda and Palm Island, they developed these great teams that would play against white teams, and they call themselves the All Black team. So you might get
All Blacks, natives, that kind of.
So these All Black teams would play against white teams. They'd also play against other All Black team. So you get Warrabinda playing Cherbourg, and then it'd be an inter-settlement competition, and it was high stakes, identity and...
Which community is...
Absolutely. So Cherbourg, for example, had a wonderful team through the 1930s and 40s, and some of those players were some of the most talented players in Queensland. But unfortunately, and this is a good example of the way in which racism works, none of those players got to represent beyond... the district area. So none of them played for Queensland at that stage. None of them played for Australia. So
so there was Indigenous participation in rugby league, but it was still sort of segregated, contained and controlled, much like the policy era of that time.
Right. So this is an era of segregation. So you had the Cherbourg team, for example, emerging in the 1920s, becoming really popular in the 1930s and super successful in the 1930s and 1940s. And they played in the local competition, but because they were inmates of Cherbourg, they had to get a pass to play those games. So they were given the formal passes through their teams, and they played in local district areas outside Cherbourg. But they got no further. And there's some great players like Frank Fisher.
Yep.
Right, a brilliant player, not only a footballer but a cricketer. And when he played against the touring English team, they said that he was the best footballer they'd seen in Australia. And he never got to play for Queensland, never got to play for Australia. And that was, of course, the institutional racism that meant that Frank Fisher had to live in Cherbourg and could only get off to work or to play football and cricket for Cherbourg.
And there's this really, I think, interesting kind of tension for me in hearing these stories about the tragedy of these, you know, amazing athletes who, if they weren't Aboriginal, would have, you know, a lot of success and fame and, you know, the intergenerational wealth that could have accrued for their families, you know, all that kind of stuff. But also there's something I wonder about the significance of, you know, playing for Cherbourg and beating all of the local districts at that time of, you know,
I think if those people could listen to us now, they'd be really annoyed if we portray them as victims. They weren't victims. They were, you know, they were powerful, strong-willed and clever people. And the really interesting thing was the way in which they used sport and rugby league at Cherbourg. I mean, it was a really powerful way to create an identity. You think about Cherbourg, it was maybe 30 or 40 different language groups.
And even the significance of, you know, we're talking about the sport, it's not just about winning or losing, but the significance of winning in that environment. And it made me think of this. So there's an African-American scholar in the 1900s, Du Bois. And Du Bois talks about this experience of double consciousness of, you know, being aware of how the world sees you, but also knowing how you see yourself and recognizing that race was inescapable. And he talks about, you know, the one place of freedom, the sort of the one escape for him is when he beats them in a test or in a running race, or this sense of, you know, winning. And it made me think about how Mob and Cherbourg experienced those wins in that environment, how significant that must have been. Because I even know when a Nala plays football against a stronger, wealthier team, which is pretty much everyone, when we win a game, that win has a greater significance than it's not just winning a game, it's winning something else.
Well, you think about life for, you know, these footballers in Cherbourg, it was really confined. They had, you know, very little autonomy, very little control over their life. Put them on a football field, all of a sudden those people who have controlled their life, they're actually tackling. They're beating and scoring tries.
Yes.
So, you know, the sense of achievement through the process of just being able to compete with other people and then to beat them and then to gather a reputation within the community and within the local community about their sporting prowess, what a great way to bring together, you know, 30 or 40 language groups and to create an identity, which was Cherbourg.
And recognise that the playing field was not level, but a win signifies the ability to disrupt how the playing field works. And I think that's really...
Well, there's a classic example of that. So Frank Fisher, this wasn't in football, but it was in cricket. He was one of the strong Indigenous men who stood up to the superintendent, you know, and in many cases stood up for other Indigenous people in the settlement if he thought it was unfair or unjust, the time treatment. Well, he was so talented at cricket that he'd be able to hit a ball outside the field itself. So he was, you know, he'd be a great one-day cricketer or 20-over cricketer, right? He'd be terrific in contemporary times. I mean, every time the superintendent showed up, sure enough, Frank Fisher would hit his car with a ball. and in the end, the superintendent worked it out and said, no, this guy's aiming for me. I'm not going to show up anymore. So that's a classic example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, you know
what I mean? You know, what a great way of showing strength and identity and resistance.
yeah.
to dominant, you know, dominant cultural forms through using sport as a tool.
Because I fast forward to the Indigenous All-Stars concept and thinking about that sense of victory and the first All-Stars game, I got to go to it down the Gold Coast and we won the game. And winning that game was significant for us. It wasn't just winning a game, it was winning something else. But there was the first try scored within the opening minutes was by Wendell Saylor. And it there's this classic, you know, and you've seen the image of the post-try celebration.
Yep. Yep.
And to me, there's something really powerful about that post-try celebration. And I guess for our listeners, what happened was Wendell Saylor, he scored a try in the corner. And he pulls out the corner post and plays it like a didgeridoo. Mm. And the other players come running over and do shake a leg. And I remember being there and we were like cheering, crying. It was, it was like something special. And I think what's significant about it was that we've always known we've had, you know, our mob playing at this elite level, particularly in Queensland. Our mob played for Queensland. So we'd seen him on the playing field, but we hadn't seen this kind of expression of, Aboriginality on the playing field. It was always kind of to the side. And I guess what made it even more significant, when we did a lecture with some students who visited our campus, we had the privilege of having Preston Campbell talk about the concept of how the concept came about and what motivated him to push for it. And he talked about playing, you know, I think it was some sort of World Cup or a Nines Carnival or something. I'm not good at facts and, but this is why I'm not a historian. But anyway, he talked about there was an Indigenous side in that world competition and there was an Australian side. And so there were the Indigenous players who could make the Australian team playing for that. And then there were the other black fellas playing in this Indigenous team. And apparently, you know, he was talking about in the dress, they were all pumped up and really enjoyed the experience. But there was an official who in the dressing sheds afterwards come up to them and said, well, I hope you enjoyed it because you're never going to get the opportunity to do that again. And he said that him and a few other players talked about the fact that, you know, our elite Indigenous players should be able to represent the mob too, you know, at an elite level. And so he was inspired to come up with this concept so that all Indigenous players in the competition had an opportunity to represent the mob at an elite level. And so then to see them, you know, the cheekiness of that post-try celebration, and to take out the corner post, you know, the corner post is the boundaries in which the game is to be played within. And so for black fellas to just, you know, score the try, win the game, but to take out the boundary, to remove it and reconfigure its use in a whole other way, in a way that really celebrated blackness, you know, on the field. It was so very powerful, such an important experience.
Yeah, it was a symbolic moment, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. But then we were yarning before about this idea of the All-Stars concept. What do you think about this, you know, going back to the days of having an All-Blacks team, pretty much?
Yeah, well, I'm a whitey and I look at it and go, what a great celebration of Indigenous identity. A lot of Indigenous people are loving this, so it has a big imprint, and I think it's a really positive thing. And you'd hope it would be something to consider going on in the future. But if you think it in a really broad context, and you go, "All right, now would African Americans do this in North America? No way in the world," because they'd be going, "No, we don't want to racialise our sport. We've been racialised our whole life." This is a step back for us. So I think in the future there'll be that will, the celebration will be tempered by, well, actually, what are we actually creating here? Because the logical extension is that you would then have not only an Indigenous team and a white team, but a Pacific Islander team.
Mm.
And then you have a racialised competition, and we're back to the 1930s.
Yeah, and I mean it's a challenging one because, I mean, there is something. I spoke to a former ex-professional rugby league player who was talking about how he's almost is envious of what the players have now because they actually get to play with their mob. He played in a time where he was the one Indigenous player on a team, and so. Like, and I think about, I'm rambling here, but I think about my kids playing for Inala. It's really important for me that my kids play. They've played at other clubs before, but playing for Inala is unique because, for the most part, they're playing with other black fellas.
Yep.
as opposed to playing for another club where there might be one or of a few Indigenous players, but they're kind of, it's, Anala's recognised as very much an Aboriginal club. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much for me about a sort of racial segregation, but it's putting that Anala jersey on and representing your community. And I think back to, like, say, the settlement competitions, that on the one hand it represents exclusion from the mainstream, but it also, for people, was about representing your community and a statement of pride. So it is this funny kind of...
Well, I've been up at Cherbourg recently and they've picked their team of the century from the Cherbourg Hornets. So, you know, there's a lot of pride that still goes on in wearing the jersey from Cherbourg.
Yeah, and I mean, and we still have the Queensland Murray Carnival.
Absolutely,
we have the knockout in New South Wales that's been going for some time. There's, we have all these Indigenous knockout rugby league carnivals, which are really interesting cultural events. For me, I don't get to play in those carnivals, but going out to, like, St. George, A-Day, I did one year, went down to Dubbo for one of the knockout carnivals, then going to the QMC here.
Yep.
It's a fascinating space to be in. The conversations you hear, the decisions about which player plays for what team and how come they're playing for this team this year, and people are doing genealogies on the sideline of how come this, they're really, I guess, rich, vibrant spaces, these carnivals, but their origins were probably grounded in this, very real racial exclusion that
And the interesting thing is, as soon as the structures of the settlement started to break down and there was a lot more kind of fluidity between in movement from the settlement to Brisbane and Brisbane to the settlement and so on, that's where you start to get these clubs in Brisbane forming in Anala and other places from people who came from Cherbourg and other places.
Mm.
And then it's these people that actually start to set up the carnivals, the rugby league knockout tournaments, which are so popular.
Yeah.
As you said, they're brilliant events. They pull Indigenous people together, they get to share culture, they get to compete, they get to contest, all the arguments you get on the sideline about...
Well, even with the Queensland Murray Carnival, there's often debates about, well, who's this team? And they're not a community, community team, they're not... Because there's this conversation going on about, well, what is an Indigenous community and a community team now? Because geographically, our communities are shifting, and so there's a whole lot of tension around.
What it shows is the way in which Indigenous identity is really intricately involved in rugby league now. So we've talked about so many different levels of rugby league. Well, at every one of those levels, there's an Indigenous presence. Sometimes a really strong Indigenous presence. Sometimes they totally dominate. I mean, if you look at the State of Origin teams, there's so many Indigenous players playing in those at the Test level. So it's hard not to ignore the brilliance and the success of Indigenous players in high-level rugby league now. State of Origin, next week it's on.
It's on. Now, there was some controversy this year. Let's go to Origin. So apparently, rumour has it that this year was the first year that New South Wales had more Indigenous players than Queensland. What's your take on the whole... because there's a myth around, even Greg Inglis, why he ended up playing for Queensland, that, he wouldn't have got a run because he's a black fella, player for New South Wales. What's your take in terms of being a sports historian? Do you think that New South Wales has historically excluded Indigenous players do you have a take on that one?
I think we've got more Indigenous people in southeast Queensland and in Queensland and in New South Wales.
Well, we do have more in numbers of population. Yeah. Do we have more, in terms of the... playing rugby league, in terms of moving up to the higher levels, do you think that, because we've only just taken over New South Wales in terms of population size, so historically they've had a...
Well, if you think about the New South Wales, there were more opportunities in New South Wales to play rugby league than there were in Queensland, because the Queensland structure was settlement related, right? So we had so many people put in settlements and forcibly removed into these institutions, and they played rugby league through these institutions. Whereas in New South Wales, the settlement structure was slightly different, so there was more opportunities, there was more urban-dwelling Indigenous people who got to play rugby league. So we had the earliest rugby league players in New South Wales. The first Australian player came from New South Wales in 1960.
Who was that?
Lionel Morgan.
Oh, okay, yes.
Okay. Then you've got Artie Beetson playing in Sydney in the 1970s and then playing the first state
of
origin game.
But he was a Queenslander too.
He's a Queenslander. But
he had to go to New South Wales to
as
make
did all
it.
The talented Queenslanders, yeah. White and black.
Yeah.
Because that's where the money was. So if you wanted to play rugby league in the 60s and 70s and 80s, you played in New South Wales. It was a premier competition and it was based in New South Wales. So we had all the really talented Indigenous people playing in New South Wales.
So should they have not had more... There should have been a higher number of Indigenous players going through then to play for New South Wales, given they would have had to go through that?
Well, logically, you'd think so, wouldn't you? So I don't know what the impediment was in New South Wales or whether it's one of those quirks of history that we just have had it. And you think about the last decade, we've had so many talented Indigenous players in Queensland. So many. And if they were, you think about it, if they were on the other side of the border, they'd be in the New South Wales teams. So I have Greg Inglis.
Do you reckon?
Absolutely.
I mean, New South Wales, they had Mundine, Blacklock and Merritt.
Yeah, true.
And they were superstars of the game. Yep. I mean, what's Merritt's first name? It's Merritt. But, you know, Blacklock, for how many years was he the number one try scorer?
Yep.
I think he got like one run and then we laugh. But over the years, when they'd have one black fella play for New South Wales and they make a mistake, we're like, he gone. He had his chance and he gone. Yep. You know, like it was, sure enough, I mean, Merritt, Blacklock and Mundine, to me, were... if they were playing for Queensland, yeah, they would have had a long history of origin. There's no doubt about it. Yeah. But they could not make New South Wales. Like, you reckon?
Well, if you think about it, state of origin for Queensland means much more than state of origin for New South Wales. So our identity hangs on this. We're the little brother punching up to the big brother all the time. So on that basis, they're going to take the best players they can get, black or white. All right, and maybe New South Wales, it didn't matter that much. Then they like to win, but hey, we'll take our white players, and if we don't,
I hate to say it, but they were dominating early on in Origin, weren't they? No, what's the?
Yeah, they, well, certainly the last 10 years has been Queensland's shining period.
It has been.
Yep.
It's been a good time. It's been a good era.
My argument is that it matters much more to Queensland than it does to New South Wales. New South Wales go, yeah, great if we win, if we lose.
You know, what blackfellas are saying is that, well, see, Queensland, we play our best players and, of course, they're blackfellas and they get a run and that's why we're winning.
Yeah.
Perhaps New South Wales could afford to exclude black players years ago because they were winning anyway.
That's right.
So they didn't need their best players. But now...
And that's right, because you had in the old system prior to state of origin was residential based. So Artie Beetson played for New South Wales against Queensland. Can you believe that? That was prior to the state of origin, and I know what that meant for Queenslanders to watch Artie Beetson play against and being such a brilliant player and ball distributor, to watch him destroy a Queensland team was just horrible. So yes, there were more choices in New South Wales and more opportunities to not to pick Indigenous people. Whereas I think in Queensland it mattered more. And they said, we don't care if you're black and white, we're going to pick you.
Because we've got to win.
We're going to win. And it's paid off.
Mm. And this year, do you think we're going to win Origin this year? What do you reckon our chances are?
I'm always optimistic.
Are you a Queenslander?
Absolutely.
Yeah, just checking. I have a few New South Wales people come in the studio. I need to, check the credentials of my guests more rigorously,
yeah.
I think.
Well, look, if they get up, it'll be fantastic, but you get the sense the sun's setting on the Queensland team.
You reckon?
Absolutely. We've got so much talent, but they're at the end of their careers. So if we find some other great players coming through, which there will be, but it'll take a period of time. What do you think? You get rid of Thurston, take him out of the game.
So Thurston's back, though, next week,
I know,
hey?
But he's at
Once
the end
he's
of
gone,
his career.
We're stuck. We
Greg,
need
Greg Inglis, when he goes, okay, it starts to add up. So to get those quality players through again, to be at their peak, it's another period of time. So I think if they can win this series, it'd be fantastic. I think the time for Queensland is going to be hard over the next few years.
And given New South Wales starting to pick more of their black fellas in their team, it's also...
This is true.
Historically, Queensland have had more Indigenous players in their side.
They have.
Proportional.
Indeed, absolutely. And
I had a colleague trying to disagree with me, saying that wasn't true. So I'm glad I've got a sports historian, associate professor, that says that's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yep. He was a New South Wales supporter, though. That's why, right. I think he'd make it up stuff.
But a lot of the early stars, Indigenous stars, came from New South Wales, though, because that's where they were given a shot.
Mm.
Okay, so it kind of makes sense. You know, you got the first Australian players, Indigenous Australian players, in the 1960s. Well, in the 1960s in Queensland, you're still locked up in some of these institutions, right?
Yep.
In New South Wales, it was a lot looser. So they were given opportunities, and it was the most powerful competition, so they would allow and pay for Indigenous people to play.
I mean, I don't disagree that there are talented Koori rugby league players,
yep.
Just that New South Wales haven't selected them. But I had a bit of conflict from the last game because, well, Queensland played Sam Thaiday, who, of course, said those comments. Are you going to talk about that in your teaching, your classes?
Yeah.
You're going to touch on that one, yeah.
Yeah.
And then so they had Thaiday in the team, and then to discover that New South Wales had more Indigenous players in their team, I was like, oh, I was really conflicted about who I was going to support.
From a Queensland, New South Wales perspective, yes, it is conflicting, but from an Indigenous perspective, this is good news, isn't it? That they're picking Indigenous players.
It is good news that they're picking Indigenous. Yeah. They're picking the best players.
Yes, they're picking the best players.
Which is great, because it means that they're picking Indigenous players. Yeah, Cameron. But yes, I mean, that's exciting, I think. And some of those players had standout performances in game one. Yeah, so that was good to see, I guess, if you're a New South Wales supporter.
True.
Yeah, but we've had a few incidents of late around race in league. I'm not sure, did you see about the footy show the other week? Had an Indigenous man on a competition. Did you hear about that?
No, I was actually overseas at a conference.
That's right, you were. Yeah. So, I mean, the footy show and racism, it kind of goes hand in hand, it would think. And so we kind of celebrate the, you know, the greater inclusion of Indigenous players at an elite level in the NRL. Mm. But then we look at the rugby league kind of show, the footy show, and racism and sexism kind of just seem part of the programming, it would seem.
Yep. Yep.
So what happened recently was there was an Indigenous man from North Queensland, I believe, who won a competition where you had to put a ball through a thing.
Passing competition.
Yeah, passing competition. Yep. And so I don't watch the footy show. I tuned out a long time ago. But so he won like $6,000 or something. And Paul Fatty Vaughton made a comment about, I guess, you know, you're going to have a good drink with the family or something. And people were kind of a bit shocked and the remark, it was a bit, So that generated some response. And then, of course, it was only 2 weeks before that Sam Thaiday's, you know, if you ain't white, you ain't right thing was said on the footy show as well.
Yep. So there is that kind of casual racism that exists at a really kind of masculine, jovial level where they think it's actually funny.
Yeah.
And don't realise the damage it does to Indigenous people and how it really plays on a history of that kind of discourse and structure. And for Indigenous people, that just digs in deep, you know, because, as you know, I'm exposed to an incredible range of talented Indigenous people achieving in so many different levels at university that we work at.
Yep.
It's just amazing.
Yep.
So those kind of what they think are jovial comments are just heart-wrenching for me. I just go, really? Move on.
Yeah.
And these guys don't. They're part of the footy culture, which is a masculine culture, of which recognises Indigenous talent, but at the same time, in the flip of a coin, can put them down in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
It's kind of tragic.
And I guess, it, you know, it's perhaps in that context of even Thaiday's remarks of, you know, taking that on, that culture and espousing those same views to be one of the guys.
And I think that does exist.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I think, because there's number of things that go on in football culture, because I've been in team sports and I know how they work, so, you know, and they change over time. But sometimes men and boys do this stuff to feel part of belonging in a group, right?
Mm.
And part of that belonging can be exclusionary and can be really divisive. And you know, Sam's comments were all that in that moment. And then within the moment when he went, wow, what did I just say? You know, he realised what he said and the implications of that for him.
Well, I don't know if he realised what he said because he'd been cheeky about it afterwards. What was interesting is that in terms of the response from Indigenous men, I had quite a number of senior Indigenous men who were really disgusted in him, more so than some of the younger men in his, and so there were a lot of younger men, just from my, you know, I didn't do extensive research here, but in terms of my social media engagement and yarning with other women and stuff, a lot of men sort of our age and younger were kind of, yeah, you shouldn't have said it, but were a bit more, kind of, you know, don't be too hard on him kind of thing. But over the you know, when this played out, it was much older Indigenous men who were really disgusted, and it kind of gave me some assurance of going, and when I thought about it, I thought some of these older men were around, you know, of the time of where our mob were on settlements and reserves, who were keenly aware of the sexual exploitation of black women under that system.
Yeah.
Who were sent away to work and came back pregnant, often, you know, to white men who had seen the exploitation of black women and the, you know, the knew, you know, what was going on, and so therefore were really outraged at those comments because they knew that history and the historical context of the sexual exploitation of black women at the hands of white men. And I think some of the generation have forgotten about that, or were not, did not experience it or witness it. You know, so perhaps there was a generational thing there going on as well, of not understanding the context. And it was, so it was, I was surprised that, that some of the people who were really, you know, angry at him were senior men. And it was, gave me some reassurance that we weren't just, you know, we weren't exaggerating this, that it actually was.
Yeah, but it's a great example of how important history is. Because if you know that history where young women were sent out as part of domestic service to all parts of Queensland with no protection, as young as 15, with little education, with little kind of sense of what the world was, then you're really sensitive to those kind of comments. Because you know how these lies played out. And as you know, Chelsea, we've done some work with some women in Cherbourg in terms of their marching girls. And one of the really interesting things for me was this marching girls emerged in the late 50s, early 60s. It was for young women between 14 and 18. And it was for those women because at 18, these women were left. Mm. They had to go out to domestic service. And for that period of time, 5 or 6 years, this was one of the most wonderful activities they did. And it was central to their identity. And we've had a reunion with these women, and, you know, it was just a fantastic time. These people talking about 50 years ago, 60 years ago, and what it meant to them. But I do remember talking with some of the women about life afterwards and how tragic that was and how even now for these women to talk about that is a really emotional moment.
Absolutely.
So when you reflect about that history in the context of Sam Thaiday's comments, yeah, that hurts.
I'm checking on the time here. What else are we going to talk about with sporting here? So with football, what are some other the hot topics you talk about in class with your students around sports and race, class and gender? Is league of kind of the passion of yours, or is it there are other sports that you think offer some particular insights?
Yeah, look, we cover a range of sports. League's popular because it's popular in Queensland. If I was if I was teaching in Melbourne and be Australian football, and we're talking about Indigenous contribution to,
because AFL's given us a lot of material.
Absolutely,
the gift that keeps on giving.
I know.
Bless.
Yeah. If I was in Melbourne, I'd be talking about AFL. But we talk about a lot about rugby league because most of the students can relate to it. We talk about rugby union too. And rugby union's a great example, though, of the way in which sports and race intersect in complex ways. So Indigenous people were given opportunities in rugby league, male Indigenous
people.
But in rugby union, those opportunities were really muted. So we can think of some fantastic Indigenous players. Right? I grew up and played against the Yellow Brothers, right?
Oh, wow.
Super players, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Super. And my generation thought, well, you know, there's so many opportunities for Indigenous people. No, these guys are plucked from obscurity, plucked from a school in Matraville, there were no other black faces in rugby union at the time. And there have been, you know, there was a whole period where rugby union was essentially excluded Indigenous people. Not by any particular rule, but by the way in which society functioned, the way in which it was structured. Because it was a private school game.
Yeah.
So it excluded Indigenous people by default, not by rule. There was no rule that said no Indigenous players could play. And it's only since, really, the Ella era and then the following era when it became a fully professional sport where they're actually after talent, black, white, or Pacific Islanders, that Indigenous people started to play rugby union in greater numbers at the higher level.
Mm. And I guess this is, I mean, the issue about racism, how racism works, though, it's often not the acts of individual people saying we want to exclude them because on the grounds of race. It's that the society functions a particular way to ensure that certain people don't have access to the same kinds of opportunities. So it's this kind of, for racialized inequality to exist, it doesn't require individual racist. Society just works really well.
No.
You know, and I say that in a sarcastic way.
Well, you know the work, some of the scholars that work around whiteness.
Yeah.
Whiteness constructs a society in which everything is naturalised around white rules and conditions and set up. And by default, anyone who's not white actually struggles to achieve a whole host of things in society. Mm. So it works really subtly. And in sport, you do have instances where there is overt racism. And we still get it, right?
It's still there.
Absolutely. But... And that still appeals to a hardcore rub of racist, those appeals. But more broadly, society doesn't condone overt racism. But racism occurs, as you said, really subtly in ways in which, for example, football is constructed. So if rugby union draws primarily from private schools, well, not many Indigenous people get the opportunity to go to private school. They're in high schools.
Well, what's interesting...
And therefore they play rugby league. Therefore they play for Queensland. Therefore they play for the Australian team. And that's just a subtle way in which kind of racist opportunities play out in sport.
And I think about my eldest boy who moved from primary school, went to Nala State School, played for a Western Nala football club, moved into a private school in high school and was like horrified that rugby league was not an option. You had to play union, and he played a couple of and not only that though, if living in Anala, it's a bit of a drive to find the nearest rugby union club even.
Right.
Whereas rugby league clubs, I can go play at Anala, you can go to Centenary, you can play Forest Lake, you can play Cache Ridge, like within a few kilometres there are several rugby league clubs. Yet it's a bit of a drive to find a union club in our neighbourhood as well as with the school. But what was interesting for me is he's come back in more recent times to play this last year to play as a 15-year-old rugby league at Anala. And I'm really glad that he's doing that, not just... And it has something to do with around cultural identity and this sense of, I think, black masculinity. So being at a private school, and there are other Indigenous kids there, but for the most part, wealthy white kids.
Yep.
And there's something special about being there each day, but then coming back to Anala and playing with the brothers who he went to primary school with, who live in his neighbourhood, and it's just different. But I think it's an important part of his identity too.
Absolutely. Yep. It's about...
So the way in which, I guess, race and gender intersect is kind of, you know, it's hard to describe in words, but I see him, his way of being in that space compared to the other space, and I go, it's really important that he has this space in which a certain kind of black masculinity is, I don't know, supported or affirmed.
And if you observe some of the representative teams, you see a similar thing. So you'll have, you know, the Indigenous players at State of Origin with a certain kind of cultural identity and relationship, same with at the Australian level.
Mm.
At one level, they're professional athletes. Another level, they've got a cultural identity that's really important to them. You see the same thing with Pacific Islanders.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to play rugby league in the way that rugby league is played, but they have to preserve their identities through playing rugby league as well. So it's a complex mix of moving between identities in certain contexts.
Mm.
And that's where I think the Indigenous All-Stars is so powerful, because that's where it allows Indigenous people to be Indigenous unequivocally.
Yes, and in your own terms, like on your own terms. Yep. There's it's not just one kind of indigeneity, but there's this idea that it all can exist in different kinds of ways. And I think that's why I think about when I see my son at Anala training with the brothers, there's a different way of being in the world. And also that class has a lot to do with it as well, because there's a sense of... belonging.
Yep.
That just is. It doesn't require a performance of a particular kind of something else, or to you can just be yourself in that space. And I think that's what I got so excited when I saw that post-try celebration of Saylor and Thurston, was that they were being themselves on the field.
Yeah, and in traditional rugby league, in what we see in State of Origin, what we see at test level and club level, there's limits around actually how they can behave. And there's more limits about not necessarily behaviour, but about how they can express themselves culturally.
And, I mean, that's... we're probably not going to have a lot more time to talk, but that's what... I mean, when the Tamana Tahu decided that I'm not going to behave in the way that we've been expected to behave in, when he walked out of Origin camp after Johns was making, you know, racial jokes about the other Indigenous players for Queensland, he broke the code.
Absolutely.
And he paid the price because he never played Origin ever again after that. He was...
But this is a negotiation that Indigenous people have to have in these team contexts all the time. There is a certain code of behaviour that exists in rugby league teams. It's about team bonding. It's about being collegial. It's about acting, training in a professional manner. And that's not necessarily how culturally people want to live their lives. Indigenous people don't necessarily want to live that way all the time, but they have to buy into that. So, but when you take the shackles off, when you allow these people to express their cultural identities and individual cultural identities, that's when it's so emotive. And for a whitey like me, to watch these Indigenous games is—it's incredible because you just see Aboriginal identity exploding. And it's almost as if it's been suppressed through them having to play these professional levels.
The suppression of Aboriginality has kind of been a thing here.
It's not unique to Aboriginal people. That's the interesting thing. So if you look at Pacific Islander players, they're exactly the same. They don't get the opportunity for cultural celebration. They have to buy into what is the power of whiteness. So, as you know, I've got a PhD student on Pacific Island Rugby League, and it's the same thing.
Well, we're going to bring him on the show in a few weeks.
He's a fantastic guy, super talented, played for New Zealand, played in England, Pacific Islander, who really understands from both inside and outside what it means to be non-white playing a white sport. It's a tricky space.
Well, playing a sport that's ours, but in a white society, or, you know,
I mean, the interesting thing is that Indigenous people are really strong in the playing rents in rugby league. But if you go through the power structure of rugby league, we've got some terrific Indigenous coaches. I absolutely don't deny that. But you look at the power structure. Who runs the clubs? Who runs the rugby league? You know, the white hierarchy is really evident in that context. So you can look at rugby league in lots of in different ways, but the power structure is still firmly white.
I had Franny Lomas from Western Isle Football Club on recently, and she was talking about, you know, she'd been running this club for a long time, often single-handedly over the years. And but she was talking about the growth of the teams and getting more women, female sides as well, that an Islanders under-15s as women's team. But she was talking about one of the things she's really working on is getting training up Indigenous coaches and managers and first aid officers and referees and including Indigenous women. As you know, in her goal is for the women's side that there will be a woman will be coaching the team and you know, all that kind of stuff. And I was thinking, oh, that's interesting, but you know, already seeing the importance of changing the game more broadly, not just the players on the field.
What we see, that's right. And if you look at North American sport, for instance, African American people were predominantly players for a long period of time. Now they've infiltrated the coaching ranks, arena, as well as the power structure. So if you look at basketball, NBA, you know, the black influence is increasingly important, and you would hope the same thing's going to happen for Indigenous people. So not only are they great players, but they get opportunities to coach as well as be part of the power structure. Then they can start to shape the culture of the sport so it works for Indigenous people. So if you look at North American basketball, for instance, I mean, there's a lot of black culture in that now.
So
that
changes the actual nature of the game and how the business of the game and all of
The whiteness gets challenged, and that would be the ultimate goal for rugby league, for an Indigenous presence to be part of how the game looks and feels and relates to
maybe
people.
That's the next job for Preston now, not just Indigenous, not just having an Indigenous team, but thinking about how the
he started that whole process. He really has.
Excuse me. Look, I'm sorry, Murray. I could yarn with you all day about sports, about racism, and about rugby league because they're things that I'm quite passionate about. But I've got to wrap up. So you're predicting that Queensland are going to lose this series?
No, I reckon Queensland are going to get up this game. Whether they win the series, I'm not sure. I hope so.
Fingers crossed. We can only hope. Well, I hope you come back on the show next time.
Anytime. Love to be here.
Thank you.
You've been tuned to Let's Talk, highlighting the injustice from community to country, suburb to city, with a multitude of hosts, Bo Spearham, Carver Watson, the aunties Lilla Watson and Mary Graham, and Chelsea Bond. Weekday mornings from 9 till 10, it's Let's Talk, welcoming the continued sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country.